sadness, one is anger, frustration, I mean, you name it.
Want to see laws in place that protect an unborn child.
With the swipe of a pen, several states approve laws enforcing tighter restrictions on abortion. This, as appellate judges with pro-life records, hear argument on the future of the abortion pill.
To show people in the world today that not only does the devil exist, but he's highly active now more than ever.
The epic battle between good and evil. Two Catholic filmmakers consider depictions of the devil in popular culture as we discuss Catholic Church teaching about battling evil and saving souls.
Sometimes when the diagnosis comes, the baby very quickly gets dehumanized.
The value and dignity of life at all stages. The organizations that accompany families of children with life-threatening conditions. EWTN News In Depth starts now.
I think a 12-week, you know, amendment was a good compromise, and that's what I said, and, you know, they didn't want to go with it.
Yes, I certainly believe the majority of South Carolinians value life.
After a contentious debate in the South Carolina State Senate this week, an abortion bill that faced a filibuster led by five female legislators passed. Governor Henry McMaster signed it into law on Thursday. It took effect immediately. The law comes after three other failed attempts in South Carolina to pass similar abortion restriction bills in the wake of the Supreme Court overturning Roe v. Wade last year. And shortly after the governor's signature, several abortion providers and pro-abortion advocacy groups filed a joint lawsuit against it. Welcome to EWTN News In Depth. There has been a flurry of activity this week with several states moving to restrict abortion. South Carolina's Fetal Heartbeat and Protection from Abortion Act bans abortion after a heartbeat is detected, usually around 6 weeks. A physician guilty of violating the ban can face 2 years of prison, be fined $10,000, or both. It's not known if the law will survive a court challenge. The state Supreme Court earlier this year struck down a similar 6-week ban over privacy concerns. Many believe the latest version will stand after changes to both the proposal's language and the court's makeup. Nebraska's Governor Jim Pillen tweeted out this picture of him signing a new abortion law on Monday. Lawmakers approved the bill late last week. The Let Them Grow and Preborn Child Protection Act bans abortions after 12 weeks. There are exceptions for rape, incest, and if the mother's life is at risk. That same bill also aims to protect minors diagnosed with gender dysphoria. It bans gender transition surgeries, hormone therapy, and puberty blockers for those under the age of 19. It led to contentious debate in the state capitol.
This bill isn't about being unsupportive of transgender children. It's about preventing irreversible changes to their bodies until they're adults. This isn't about ignoring women's rights. It's about protecting the rights of babies who have the right to live.
So I'm just gonna say the unvarnished truth. That this place is morally bankrupt, that you are playing political games with the lives of children and parents in this state to get something. It's gross. It's vile.
The gender transition ban for minors goes into effect in October. The abortion ban took effect immediately after the governor's signature. And in North Carolina, pro-abortion demonstrators expressed outrage after lawmakers approved an abortion ban after 12 weeks, overriding the governor's veto. It replaces the current 20-week ban. Exceptions include instances of rape or incest and for life-threatening anomalies. In those cases, access to abortion is extended several weeks. The law also includes $180 million for contraceptives, access to childcare, and 8 weeks of paid parental leave for state employees. It goes into effect July 1st. We continue to follow an abortion-related court case, the appeal over the abortion pill mifepristone. The U.S. Supreme Court blocked a lower court order that would have taken mifepristone off the market, saying that availability should remain in place while the appeals process plays out. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in Louisiana heard argument in that appeal just last week. The Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine alleges that the Food and Drug Administration ignored its own research and testing standards when approving mifepristone. The drug is one of two medications used to complete a chemical abortion and used in more than 50% of abortions in America. Justice Department lawyers representing the FDA deny the plaintiff's claim that the drug is unsafe and had not been properly vetted, saying it went through rigorous scientific testing before it was approved more than 20 years ago. The three judges who heard the argument, James Ho, Corey Wilson, and Jennifer Elrod, have a history of pro-life rulings and had particularly tough questions for the Justice Department and pharmaceutical company lawyers. The panel did not indicate when it will rule. And as decisions are released with the wind down of this year's term, we're following several cases at the U.S. Supreme Court. Appellate attorney and constitutional scholar Adam White joins us to talk about the decisions we're waiting on. Adam served on the Presidential Commission on the Supreme Court and is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Adam, it's great to have you here with us. Let's start with one case where we already know the decision. What we dubbed the case about pork that really isn't about pork. Out of California, we had the National Pork Producers Council challenging a California regulation that asked pork producers selling within the state to treat their pigs with specific care guidelines or be refused the ability to sell their products in the state. Why should we care about this for businesses?
It was a case about pork, but it was primarily a case about interstate commerce. The Constitution gives Congress the power to regulate interstate commerce, and there's always been questions about how much power the states themselves have to interfere with interstate commerce. California, in effect, tried to reach out beyond its state borders and regulate industries outside of the state. The Supreme Court majority said that's okay because California was primarily trying to regulate sales within the state. But as the dissenters pointed out, this leaves a lot of room for states like California to try to wield disproportionate weight in the American marketplace and, in effect, try to export their policies to other states.
And how could this have some kind of implications for issues like abortion? I know that's on everyone's minds.
Well, in the aftermath of the Dobbs case, there are questions about the extent to which states might be able to limit not just abortions within the state, but also limit the ability of people to travel out of state for abortions or for companies outside of states to serve customers within the state. And so there have been questions about the extent to which states might be able to limit the flow of those services in or out of the state, the flow of people in and out of the state. Frankly, the Supreme Court's decision, I don't think said a lot implicitly to those issues, but a lot of us were watching for clues.
Any clues that we can look to?
Not yet. Right now, the fight over post-Dobbs abortion cases really does seem to be focused first and foremost, as you pointed out, not in the states, but in the administrative state, where federal agencies under the Biden administration really are trying to push forward on a pro-abortion agenda in spite of the laws that govern those agencies.
Well, let's switch to another issue, the issue of wedding vendors that continues at the Supreme Court since the creation of same-sex marriage in 2015 with the Obergefell case. A Christian wedding website designer in Colorado that sued to protect herself and others over the Colorado Anti-Discrimination Act, which would force her to violate her conscience and provide her creative services for same-sex unions. What can we expect with this case?
Well, this case reminds us how difficult it is, especially in industries around weddings, to strike the right constitutional balance between the regulation of commerce, the freedom of speech, and the freedom of religion. Here in this case, the court is primarily focused on the free speech issue, whether the state's regulations of this wedding website service violates the web designer's free speech rights, but of course it is bound up with her religious beliefs. It seemed after oral argument that the Supreme Court majority was leaning in favor of defending free speech rights in this case, but it's not clear, even if they do rule in that direction, where they'll draw lines, because over and over again, we're going to see commercial regulation that touches on free speech, especially in the context of same-sex marriage.
And anti-discrimination laws. How is this case different from the Jack the Cake Baker and other wedding vendor cases that have come up to the court?
Well, in the bakery case, there were a lot of questions and debate about whether the making of a specialty cake constituted the expression of views or religious beliefs by the baker. Here, when you're talking about web design, it is clearly speech. The question is whether it's the speech of the viewpoint of the web designer. I think it is much more, even more clearly a free speech case than the Masterpiece Cake Shop was on free exercise of religion. And of course, there were real free exercise of religion considerations at issue.
There's a concept called public accommodations that everyone talks about when you think about these cases. Basically, if I come into your shop and you're set up in the marketplace, you have to serve me and you have to do what I ask for, whether I'm LGBTQ or a Christian asking someone who doesn't believe in Christian beliefs to work with them. What can you tell us about that? Any clarity there?
Well, this is a really hard issue. In our country, we've long prevented commercial interests, companies and others, from discriminating on the basis of race, on the basis of sex, and so on. This is another core commitment of American government and American political life. But in these cases, it is bumping up against the free speech and free and religious free exercise interests of the business owners. And in the Masterpiece Cake Shop, we saw, and this was the heart of the court's concerns, we saw a real effort to target the bakery, not just by the litigants in that case, but by some of the people in the Civil Rights Commission in Colorado. So that often is hovering around these cases too, the intentions of the regulators who seem to be targeting particular kinds of companies for particularly bad treatment.
Well, we'll have a conversation about regulators in a moment, but let's talk about another case argued on April 18th, just last month, and it's also pending a decision. A former part-time mail carrier, an evangelical Christian, sued the U.S. Postal Service for having to work on Sundays. This is the issue of protecting Sabbath observance, but also of religious accommodations by big businesses. What does the law currently say?
Well, a moment ago I said that our civil rights laws protect customers against illegal discrimination. Another part of the Civil Rights Act also protects employees against discrimination on the basis of race and sex and also on religious belief. It's supposed to protect your ability to exercise your religion without discrimination against you by your employer. Of course, sometimes employers do need people to, say, work on the weekends and so on. So the law tries to strike a balance. You're entitled as a religious employee, you're entitled to a reasonable accommodation, but not one that imposes an undue hardship on the employer. So in this case, the Postal Service, which is being sued not because it's part of the government, but because it's an employer, the Postal Service is being challenged for not allowing this person to have off on the Sabbath. The Postal Service has a contractual relationship with Amazon for delivering packages now on the weekends. And the parties seem to agree that the existing case law is a little dissatisfactory. It probably isn't clear enough, and it probably doesn't, the case law doesn't provide enough protection for religious liberty. The question is how much more protection will the employee get in this case? And we have yet to see.
Yeah, and we're talking about Title VII religious protections, right? Where, unfortunately, there's another fancy legal term, de minimis. These tiny, tiny accommodations that businesses have to make for our religious rights. Doesn't religious freedom deserve a little more than that?
Well, again, the text of the law seems to require more than that, too. It speaks not in terms of more than de minimis burdens on the employer, but an undue hardship on the employer. And the justices and even the government, the Postal Service, seem to recognize that the existing de minimis standard probably isn't enough protection. The question is just how much more protection, and does the Postal Service's interests in this case, in terms of this particular location, this particular set of employees, this particular employee who's looking for an exemption, whether the Postal Service needs to allow this person to not work on the Sabbath.
Well, Adam, we're going to be looking to your expertise when these decisions come down. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Monty.
We're also following two other major cases with pending decisions before the 4th of July. The first revolves around affirmative action. In the Students for Fair Admissions versus President and Fellows of Harvard College case, petitioners allege that the admissions process to Harvard discriminates against Asian Americans in favor of white applicants with the use of affirmative action. They claim affirmative action, which is intended to promote opportunities for minority groups to give them equal access to jobs, education, and more, constitutes racial discrimination, and that it violates the Equal Protection Clause. Harvard says that it does not discriminate against any group and is simply fulfilling its mission of diversity. The case against Harvard was consolidated for oral argument at the Supreme Court with a similar case challenging admissions at the University of North Carolina last October. Holland versus Brackeen focuses on the Indian Child Welfare Act, the 1978 federal law governing the adoptive placement of Native American children, seeks to keep them with Native American families. Native American tribes say the law is one of the most important pieces of federal Indian legislation ever enacted. In this case, petitioners tried to foster or adopt children with Indian ancestry. They say the law is racially discriminatory and unconstitutional. Chief Justice John Roberts addressed the issue of court ethics and transparency this week. Questions have come to the forefront after a series of news reports about financial gifts from a conservative billionaire to Justice Clarence Thomas. Those gifts include luxury travel, purchases of Thomas-owned property, and tuition payments for a Thomas relative. Though these gifts have made Thomas a focus, there have been questions about other justices' financial circumstances, including spousal compensation and real estate dealings.
And on a final issue of concern inside the court, I want to assure people that I am committed to making certain that we as a court adhere to the highest standards of conduct. We are continuing to look at things we can do to give practical effect to that commitment.
Some lawmakers are calling for a new code of ethics and greater transparency for the Supreme Court, guidelines commonplace for federal judges in the lower courts. Of great concern is whether ethical controversies are creating a public crisis of confidence in the Supreme Court. Ahead on EWTN News In Depth, the official Eucharistic pilgrimage routes are released by the National Eucharistic Congress. We'll show you the paths aimed to spark a revival for the Lord.
We have reported all allegations of child sexual abuse by clergy to civil authorities.
A major new investigation into church sex abuse allegations in one state. Hundreds more clergy named. The response from church leaders. Paying homage to those who have died for their belief in Jesus. The ecumenical importance of Pope Francis honoring martyrs who are not Catholic. We'll explain when we return. A joint blessing from Pope Francis and the Orthodox Coptic Pope, Patriarch Tewodros II of Alexandria. The moment earlier this month in St. Peter's Square reflected the ongoing ecumenical outreach between our faiths and was a celebration of the landmark meeting between our two churches just 50 years ago. That meeting between Pope St. Paul VI and Coptic Pope Shenouda III happened in 1973. It was the first time the Bishop of Rome and the Coptic Patriarch of Alexandria met in more than 1,500 years. During the historic visit at the Vatican, they signed a common declaration on the issue of Christology. Christology is the study of the person of Jesus, in particular, the mystical union of his divine and human natures. The declaration crowned years of ecumenical and theological dialogue between the churches and cemented a path towards spiritual communion. To give you a little background, the Coptic Church traces its origins to the founding of the See of Alexandria by St. Mark the Evangelist. He was the disciple of St. Peter. The Coptics were originally in communion with Rome, but broke away in the 5th century after disagreements over Christology. So the meeting in 1973 was a tremendous moment of outreach between the churches. A significant moment during this year's meeting was the addition of 21 Coptic Orthodox martyrs to the Roman Martyrology, which is the church's official listing of martyrs and saints. The martyrs were beheaded on a beach in Libya by the terrorist organization ISIS, the Islamic State, in 2015.
The infamous video published by the terrorists showed the men praying as they died. One of those men hailed from Ghana. The other 20 were Egyptian. Most Coptic Orthodox Christians are Egyptian. There are also significant populations of Coptic Orthodox in Syria, Libya, Jordan, and other countries, including Australia and the United States. The Copts, as they're often referred to, are considered the largest population of Christians in the Middle East and the largest religious minority in Egypt. The U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom says they face ongoing systemic discrimination, which includes violent attacks, restrictions on building new churches, and required carrying of religious affiliation ID cards. To help us better understand the gravity of Pope Francis's meeting with the Coptic Pope, we're joined by Dr. Matthew Bunsen, EWTN News Executive Editor. Matthew, thank you for being with us. Has the Catholic Pope ever added people who are not technically Catholic to the Roman Martyrology?
Yes, this decision by Pope Francis came as a bit of a surprise to a lot of people, but it certainly cannot be called unprecedented. In the history of the Church, we have had a number of additions to the Roman Martyrology of people who weren't perhaps in communion with the Church. And what I mean by that is that they may have been members of the Orthodox churches. I think in particular of Gregory Palamas, a 13th century Eastern theologian who had actually quite a few criticisms for Western Christianity and yet was considered a great theologian and a great saint. And we also have Ambrose of Smolensk, a Russian saint of the 13th century, who was actually canonized officially for the Church by Pope Paul III in 1549. But probably the best example is Gregory of Narek, an 11th century Armenian monk, who not only was added to the calendar by Pope Francis, he was actually called a saint by John Paul II before Pope Francis, but Francis went so far as to name him one of the doctors of the Church. So this is not unheard of, but it's also a very powerful statement, I think, by Pope Francis of the importance of the witness of martyrs, especially today, as pointing all of us toward that unity that we face in giving that witness to Christ.
Now, Matthew, we use this phrase in communion with the Church. What are the differences that make someone not in communion with the Church?
Well, primarily in this case with the Orthodox, we have those who do not recognize the Pope as the head of the Church. That was a great sticking point over the centuries, and it remains one among the churches. We had disagreements, for example, theologically, as you noted, in terms of the Coptic Christians, who really split from Rome in 451 in the Council of Chalcedon over some of the more complicated matters in terms of Christology. But the big sticking point remains recognizing the Holy Father.
So it doesn't have anything to do with the nature of the Eucharist?
Correct. And that became important, as we know, with the celebration of the Divine Liturgy by Pope Tawadros II in Rome during his visit there.
We'll get to that in 1 second. So the Pope received relics of these 21 martyrs. Who were these men, Matthew?
These were average Coptic Christians and one other. There were 20 Coptics who were seized by ISIS. They were construction workers working from Egypt and in Libya in the city of Sirte. And they had among them a member of their group from Ghana. His name was Matthew Ayariga. We're not entirely sure even today what his background was in terms of his faith. But ISIS seized these 20 workers, plus this gentleman from Ghana, these Coptic Christians, and as you noted, and as the world watched in horror, executed them on a beach. All of them were immediately declared martyrs and were canonized by the Coptic Church. Matthew Ayariga stands as something of an outlier with this group, however, because like all of them, he was offered the ability, the chance to save himself. And each one of them, all 21, refused to abjure their faith, to give up Christ. It is said that Matthew Ayariga, again, who is apparently not a Coptic Christian, said, "Their God is my God." And at the very end, died with them. And notably, too, as we can see in the video, which I don't recommend anyone watching in any graphic detail, but all of them died with the name of Jesus on their lips, making them remarkable witnesses to Christ in the face of the horror of ISIS.
The Coptics in Egypt have suffered greatly. We mentioned a few ways in which they suffer persecution. What are the more egregious examples? Of course, this martyrdom is one of them.
Yeah. Well, the Coptic Christians over the centuries have suffered immensely at the hands of the different controlling empires of Egypt. I think of the Fatimids, as well as the Mamelukes and the Ottomans, names that are part of history. But it's been especially in the modern era that the Coptic Christians have suffered so immensely. We can think, for example, of the 2011 bombing that killed, I think, almost two dozen and wounded over 100 in Alexandria. And then there are the sufferings of individual Coptic Christians in Egypt on a daily basis at the hands of those who simply hate Christians, who are on the watch, for example, for any accusations of blasphemy against Muhammad or the Islamic faith. So it is a day-to-day existence that they face, and that's something that I think we have to be reminded of. And I think this statement by Pope Francis and the canonization of them by the Coptic Orthodox Church is so significant in terms of these martyrs.
They are significant moves by Pope Francis. While Pope Tawadros II celebrated the Divine Liturgy at the Basilica of St. John Lateran, there was recent outrage after the Church of England held a service in the same church. That service was blamed on a, quote, failure of communication. Why is a mass by the Coptic Orthodox Patriarch allowed and not the other one?
Well, we're comparing theologically and sacramentally apples and oranges. In the case of the Anglicans, our position on that is that they are not, in terms of the apostolic succession, that these are not valid priests. And therefore, the celebration of the Eucharist is not valid either. In the case of Pope Tawadros, we recognize that the sacraments of the Orthodox Church are valid. They are in schism and remain so. They're not in communion, but because they have maintained the apostolic succession in terms of our belief, and for us, it was an important distinction that had to be made and very quickly. In addition, as you noted, the Anglicans celebrated their liturgy in the Basilica, the Archbasilica, because of a failure of miscommunication. In the case of the Divine Liturgy by Pope Tawadros, this was something that had been organized very carefully, and steps had been taken to make certain, for example, of which altar was used and that everything was done appropriately.
There are a lot of rules surrounding that. Well, thank you so much for all of this clarity, Matthew.
Good to be with you.
Still to come, bringing the faith to the world through art. The recent bronze sculpture installed in our nation's capital. We speak with the artist who created it.
Who would you go to for guidance if you found out that your unborn or newborn child had a life-threatening condition? I'm Alan Holdren, and I'll take you through a few of the options out there for getting good, immediate, and free counsel from a Catholic perspective.
When parents discover their child does not have long to live, navigating the medical advice, the decisions, and the profound grief can seem overwhelming. Alan Holdren continues his series on living and dying well with some hopeful advice from a Catholic perspective on how to cope in this Catholic Life report.
We were told that around 90% of these little babies don't make it to their first birthday.
Tracy Harkin and her husband Tom of County Down, Ireland, were living in Seattle when their daughter Kathleen was born. Shortly after birth came an unexpected diagnosis. Kathleen had trisomy 13. Doctors there predicted she would live a very short and difficult life. Tom and Tracy had to fight for her right to basic medical care.
Day by day we were learning what we could, trying to get information, which at that time wasn't readily available on this condition. So we were sent home. And basically, looking back, and even at the time, I think we were getting, you know, snippets of the truth in our minds. She was basically being sent home to die.
That was in 2006. They were sent home without any equipment, which Kathleen needed. With the family's proactivity and care, in spite of the doctor's predictions, Kathleen lived for another 15 years until December 13th of 2021.
She was able to do so much more than we were told, and she just became the very heart of our home and a real personality. Mm-hmm. And you know, but yet in those early days, we weren't told any of that. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes parents can feel that even a feed tube is extraordinary, and there can be a lot of confusion about that. And that's where you really need to find out and to network with other parents that have had these children. And it's really good to have a really good grounding in what church teaching is about these issues, because it can mean the difference between life and death. It can mean, it's very comforting as a parent to know that you're on the right path.
The church teaches that all life has value, is sacred in God's eyes, and at the very least deserves ordinary medical care. Sometimes that earthly life isn't destined to last very long. Other times, parents can and must fight for that care that may save their child's life.
Studies cited by the CDC report that each year in the U.S., of every 175 babies, one is stillborn and another dies in the first year of life. That's 42,000 souls. Wherever you are, if problems arise in those delicate first moments, it's important to know who to speak with.
It's incredibly important to have good medical professionals, you know, doctors who share your values, ideally, you know, a wonderful Catholic doctor. But in any case, there is a requirement, you know, that that informed consent be respected, that they get the support that they need from the church, from centers like the NCBC, friends and family, et cetera, to really explore all of their options.
At what point in Catholic teaching is there a clear line where parents, I guess, just need to let go and to let God take that life?
So in a certain sense, there isn't like a clear, bright line of, you know, what one has to do, except for the, you know, ordinary care, which is always morally required. But otherwise, there is a need to make a discernment, and it's not always 100% clear cut. You know, it does fall into the realm of conscience.
Dr. Joseph Meany is the director of the National Catholic Bioethics Center in Philadelphia. He and other bioethicists take turns being on call, around the clock, to talk people through their options in difficult situations, including for parents and their babies.
One of the big problems is that sometimes people are only presented with one option that may not be acceptable. And to say, well, wait a second, we need to find other options here. There is no problem in trying and looking to find other solutions. But sometimes, you know, there's a lot of pressure that is being put. And so families do need to stand up for their rights and to be aware of their rights.
Siena, Italy is the home of the prominent Italian Catholic neonatal doctor and professor Carlo Bellieni, who has spent his life assisting nascent children, seeking to improve their chances of survival. He has an important message to share with parents of disabled newborns.
We should explain one thing, that a life with a disability doesn't mean necessarily a life with suffering. We should explain this with all our strength, because parents or even daughters can take decisions of suspending active treatments on the basis of a fear of a future disability. And it is a sort of discrimination of disabled people.
Back in Ireland, every life counts, helps people locally, and even abroad when they're able, with unexpected pregnancies or even unexpected fetal conditions during pregnancies. Every Life Counts exists to provide parents with advice and even concrete assistance when they can.
But initially, they need a safe place to just reset and to process the trauma that we believe, the trauma of the diagnosis, and to just settle with that and to find good factual information and just somebody to say, we know how you feel, and just to give them that space initially to talk and to find out information. We find that when parents have that, they actually, apart from seeing that, you know, this baby is more than likely going to die, they can see that how much joy and love can be surrounded by this baby, and how much time they can have with their baby, and that they can start loving their baby now and having that time now. So we offer them the space to do that. We offer them the gift of time.
Regardless of the diagnosis, every life is precious. And when there are unexpected issues, help can be just a phone call away. With the collaboration of EWTN Ireland, Alan Holdren, EWTN News in Depth.
Alan will be back with the last part of this series in 2 weeks, when we discuss how to make good decisions regarding your loved ones at the end of their lives, advice from a Catholic perspective. And if you would like more information about coping with the death of a child, the National Catholic Bioethics Center has many resources which can help you and your family through a difficult time.
I think that the devil gets to trick a lot of people by, you know, you're not realizing the threat that's there.
good versus evil. Coming up, we take a look at demonic depictions in popular culture. Such stories are normally overdramatized and exaggerated. With the release of some new films about exorcism, we ask, what does the Catholic Church teach about the devil? And is faith diminishing in America? We have the results of a new poll on the importance of religion in our society. The Week in Review, when we return.
An alarming investigation into clergy sex abuse in the state of Illinois tops the Week in Review. The report out of Chicago indicates hundreds of perpetrators and criticizes glaring cover-ups of pedophile priests.
Each diocese's historic handling of child sex abuse, and specifically how inaction by Catholic bishops and archbishops often led to scores of abused children.
The five-year investigation focused on decades of old and new abuse cases in the six dioceses throughout Illinois. Nearly 2,000 survivors of sex abuse were documented over a 70-year span. A total of 451 Catholic clerics and religious brothers were cited as abusers. The report contains recommendations for handling future sex abuse allegations.
Today, I offer, in the name of the diocese, my own name, my most profound apology to anyone who was harmed by a representative of the church through abuse here in our 28 counties of the Diocese of Belleville.
My hope is that the release of this report will be an occasion for the Attorney General to issue a rallying cry to all adults to join in the work of safeguarding children, lest this moment be a lost opportunity.
The Archdiocese of Chicago and the other Illinois dioceses also released a statement saying they're working with the Attorney General to update their approach, provide pastoral support to victims, and take steps to prevent such abuse from occurring again. The Illinois report comes just weeks after a clergy sex abuse report in Baltimore that alleges more than 100 clergy members in the Archdiocese of Baltimore abused at least 600 children in the span of six decades. A leading figure in the Catholic Church's effort to protect children from child abuse is named in a new lawsuit claiming inadequate supervision of a Boston Catholic school vice principal accused of abusing students. Cardinal Sean O'Malley, Boston's Archbishop and the president of the Pontifical Commission for the Protection of Minors, and two bishops are cited in the suit. It outlines alleged sexual abuse at Arlington Catholic High School in Massachusetts from 2011 to 2016. Three boys, who were between 15 and 17 years old at the time, say the school administrator assaulted them while they were serving detention. The Archdiocese said it does not comment on pending litigation, but said the allegations at the time were reported to law enforcement and the vice principal was let go from his job. The lawsuit claims O'Malley and the bishops failed in their responsibility to protect children in the Archdiocese. The LA Dodgers are reversing course and re-inviting a group that openly desecrates the Catholic faith back on the field. It's all in the name of Pride celebrations in June. The so-called Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence describe themselves as an order of queer and trans nuns. They have a decades-long history of obscenely satirizing the Catholic faith, including mock masses. The Dodgers originally rescinded their invitation to this group in light of criticism from Catholic advocacy groups. But then they issued an apology to the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence after threats from other LGBTQ plus groups to pull out of the Pride event. The Dodgers wrote in part, after much thoughtful feedback from our diverse communities, the Los Angeles Dodgers would like to offer our sincerest apologies to the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, members of the LGBTQ plus community, and their friends. The Archdiocese of Los Angeles, in turn, issued a statement writing, "The Archdiocese calls on all Catholics to stand against bigotry and hate in any form and to stand for respect for one another and for religious beliefs of our communities of faith." It goes on to call on Catholics to show care for women religious by donating to their orders or supporting them through prayer. The Pride event at Dodger Stadium will be held June 16th. A new study about religion in America shows the importance of religion in our lives is shrinking. The Public Religion Research Institute surveyed 6,000 Americans from all 50 states. Only 16% said religion is the most important thing in their lives, down from 20% a decade ago. And the highest percentage of people who have left a religious tradition are Catholic. Among those who identify as evangelical Protestants, 38% were previously Catholic. Among those who identify with a non-Christian religion, 47% were formerly Catholic. There's much to delve into in this survey. For more coverage, see our article at CatholicNewsAgency.com. The National Eucharistic Congress has released the official paths of Eucharistic pilgrimage. Four cross-country Eucharistic processions, each with a patron saint. The St. Junipero Serra route starts in San Francisco. The Marian route kicks off in Bemidji, Minnesota. The St. Juan Diego route begins in Brownsville, Texas. And from the east, the St. Elizabeth Ann Seton route originates in New Haven, Connecticut. The faithful are invited to join in along any portion of the walk.
There's so many different ways in which you can take part in the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage. And so we had a religious sister reach out asking if her community could man a water station for the pilgrims as they came through, and in a certain way, be cheerleaders.
Along the way, pilgrims will make stops in churches, colleges, holy sites, and more. You have plenty of time to sign up. The processions begin on May 17th of 2024. Just head over to eucharisticpilgrimage.org. And it's official, Pope Francis will be attending World Youth Day this summer. The Vatican confirmed Francis will preside over the Lisbon event as well as travel to Fatima. This will be the fourth World Youth Day Francis will host and his second pilgrimage to Fatima. World Youth Day kicks off August 1st until the 6th. EWTN will be providing full coverage on air, online, and in print. A few new movies this spring have captured a lot of attention. They revolve around heaven and hell, exorcism, and demonic possession. But aside from the sensational, often captured in popular culture and the media, what does the church teach about the devil? With the release of these new films, reporter Mark Irons looked for answers.
Do you believe in the devil?
No.
Do you believe in the devil?
I do.
You only do because God allows it.
It's not a question you get every day. Do you believe in the devil?
Not really, no.
Whatever your answer, depictions of the devil or the demonic are real throughout culture, found in art, music, or film. Newsweek writing about it in a recent article saying, quote, "The devil is front and center in movies, TV shows, podcasts, and even children's books." But what message do these different depictions of the devil convey? Last month, Sony Pictures released The Pope's Exorcist. It dramatizes demonic possession. The film, starring Russell Crowe, has already made more than $70 million. Among the critics, Catholic priests, who are real-life exorcists, the International Association of Exorcists stating, "Everything is exaggerated, with striking physical and verbal manifestations typical of horror films."
Often the depiction of Satan and evil powers is sensationalized, romanticized.
Father Thomas Petrie, a Catholic priest and president of the Dominican House of Studies in Washington, D.C., says one of the problems with some popular demonic depictions, they might leave you thinking the devil is fake.
So people can easily dismiss it. This is just another, it's another anti-hero, it's another villain.
More than skeptical of the devil, data suggests people are questioning the existence of hell. A 2021 Pew Research Center survey found 73% of U.S. adults believe in heaven, while fewer, 62%, believe in hell. What about the devil?
No, I don't believe in the devil.
The devil is most decidedly real. I mean, we know that as a fact of faith.
Looking back at the Genesis account of Adam and Eve, the Catechism of the Catholic Church states, "Behind the disobedient choice of our first parents lurks a seductive voice opposed to God, which makes them fall into death out of envy. Scripture and the Church's tradition see in this being a fallen angel called Satan or the devil. The teaching of the Church affirms the existence of hell and its eternity." Convincing the culture becomes the challenge.
I think maybe a lot of people get their beliefs from what they see on TV and stuff.
It's an environment that the devil has a good stronghold in, which is, you know, the Hollywood culture.
Father Darren Merlino, a Claretian missionary priest in Los Angeles, hopes to change that. He believes thought-provoking and faith-inspired content accessible to the mainstream can help evangelize.
For us to change the culture is faith-based evangelizers, we have to do it one show at a time.
So among some of the misleading demonic portrayals in media, there are attempts to set the record straight.
Do you believe in demonic possession?
No.
Well, you won't believe anything I'm about to tell you.
Father Merlino was an advisor to a film that was released on the same day as The Pope's Exorcist last month. It's called Nefarious, and it highlights the testimony of a possessed man who unveils how the devil tries to lead people to hell through their own sins.
The whole thing about this movie is to take the devil out of the darkness into the light.
The Catholic filmmakers behind it, Chuck Konzelman and Carrie Solomon, have produced movies like God's Not Dead and the pro-life film Unplanned. Those productions bringing in many faith-based viewers, but their latest film is advertised like mainstream horror.
But we use that poster as a Trojan horse to bring people that are not with God into the movie.
They say this is their best work yet, and in a real sense, the movie Christians, including Catholics, have been asking them for years, one that can reach family or friends who have no faith or have fallen away.
No one's going to listen to a minister or priest preaching the gospel, not at least not in a film. So we're using a demon to do that. And the irony is there, they'll not only listen, but they're riveted.
One Catholic priest has taken a similar approach in a popular podcast. The Exorcist Files, released this year, has more than 1 million downloads. The producer, Father Carlos Martins, an exorcist, is using dramatic reenactments of his case files to educate, attempting to reach an audience that may not be sitting in the church pews. Though demonic possession is rare, Father Martins warns the devil can gain influence when grave sins are committed.
The most common conditions whereby possession occurs, in my experience, is a violation of the first commandment, in particular, where there is a dabbling in the occult, in the dark arts, fortune-telling, Ouija board playing, spiritual mediumship, that kind of reality.
Father Thomas Petrie adds, the victory over sin, Satan, and the powers of hell has already been won by Jesus.
And if we are already marked by his victory, which we are marked by the grace of baptism, and if we're doing all the things that Catholics do in their spiritual life, like going to Mass and praying and staying closer to the Lord, then we can have the confidence that the devil cannot touch us.
Scripture tells us the devil tempted Jesus himself. Earlier this year, Pope Francis used that example to remind the faithful how to look to Christ during times of personal trials, saying, quote, Jesus defeats the temptations, but how does he conquer them? By avoiding discussion with the devil and responding with the Word of God. 50 years ago, in 1973, The Exorcist was released. It was a Hollywood hit. Theaters were packed. For the filmmakers of Nefarious, cinema success today would include a return to faith.
We're up against the same old adversary we've always been up against, but most of society has rejected the defenses. They've rejected the sacraments, they've rejected prayer, they've rejected Mass, they've rejected confession of sins and absolution. When you lay down your arms voluntarily, the enemy doesn't lay down theirs.
Mark Irons, EWTN News in Depth.
In this month of May, when the Church honors Mary, Pope Francis has said that when we go through difficult times or have problems or worries, Mary is our shield and protects us from evil. Where she is, the devil does not enter.
We were made in the image and likeness of God, and I think sometimes we forget that. I think this statue tells us about hope and possibility.
Evoking feelings of hope for the future of the pro-life movement, the sculpture that shines a light on the unborn.
Is a wonderful way to express beliefs, capture history, stimulate discussion and ideas, and reflect the joy, anger, or sadness a subject evokes. The recent installation of a bronze sculpture in Washington, D.C. aims to evangelize. It's placed on the grounds of the Theological College on the Catholic University of America's campus. We spoke with the artist, Timothy Schmalz, about the meaning and hopes of his work for our Images of the Week.
It's very important to have the face of our faith represented on the streets across the world. The sculpture, as you can see, is a woman, I interpret it as Mary, holding the child. The child just so happens not to be born yet. On the womb, what I did was I used a different material. I used mirrored steel, which reflects all light. It pulls light in. I believe that each sculpture I do is a form of prayer. We have to celebrate human life, and that's what the sculpture is saying. If it touches one person, I think it's done its job.
Thanks for watching EWTN News In Depth. Tune in next week for a report from Ireland at the apparition site of Our Lady of Knock. That story and, of course, coverage on issues important to your Catholic faith. See you then.